online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Oenologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, Hannah Crosby, author of Corker, billed as a deeply unserious wine book. She'll tell me why it's time to rip up the rules and forget everything we think we know, how to navigate a pub wine list, and how to choose the right bottle for some of life's big and small defining moments. Hannah Crosby poured her first bottle of wine in a restaurant at the age of 17. Most recently, she's been profiled in Vogue. It's been quite a journey, but that has also taken in Channel 4's Sunday Brunch, London's Evening Standard, and even recently standing in for Jancis Robinson at the Financial Times. Her first book, Corker, is already causing a stir, billed on the front cover as a deeply unserious wine book. It aims to punctuate some of the pretensions around wine with a wry take on pairing. And I'm delighted to say Hannah joins us now. Hannah, welcome to The Drinking Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. I really enjoyed the book, read the preview PDF copy, which is always a kind of unreal experience when you're reading a book, but I still managed to become really absorbed in it, which is a great sort of success, triumph on your part. You also say at the start, there's no such thing as a stupid question, which is excellent news. You haven't heard any of mine yet. Your own wine journey, tell us how you kind of got into wine.
Yeah, sure. So I have been talking about this a lot recently, and I think the way I can best kind of summarize it is that I got into wine the same way a lot of normal people do. So by normal people, I mean people whose parents aren't already in wine or don't really have any existing knowledge of the wine industry. So my parents both, growing up, both didn't drink, which is like pretty interesting for saying that I am Scottish. So grew up in like a relatively teetotal household. And yeah, I got into wine the same way a lot of people do. I worked in restaurants. So it was always instilled in me kind of growing up, you know, as soon as you turn 15, 14, you go out, get a job. And for me, that job was always restaurants. So I worked to be able to afford to go to university. I worked while I was at university to be able to stay at university. Worked to be able to afford to move to London. And then when I was in London, I worked in restaurants as well. And I think that that's most people's first real interaction with wine. So it was there I kind of became fascinated with the relationship that food and wine have with one another. So how a really amazing bottle of wine can elevate a dish and vice versa. I mean, in terms of popular media, when I would kind of consume food media or the people that you see on TV, they're at the time, some 10 years ago, far more relatable than those that you saw in wine. And you kind of only really saw, if you weren't aware of the industry too much like I was, you really kind of only are aware of one person or one type of person, and that wasn't someone that I felt that I could relate too much. So the interest in wine kind of lay, I say dormant, but it kind of popped up in various ways. Like I would always be the person to order wine on a date because I am an incredibly stubborn person. I would always be the person to save up and bring a nice bottle of wine to pre-drinks at university. And then I decided to get my qualifications finally, you know, make it official under lockdown. And then I kind of noticed that over lockdown, a lot of young people, it drew their drinking habits into sharp focus. And a lot of young people really wanted to learn about wine. They just didn't really know where to start. And like me, when I was at the start of my wine journey, I didn't really have anyone I could relate to. So I started kind of posting on social media, talking about the wines I was drinking, and a lot of people really resonated with it. And then out of lockdown, I would get asked by, you know, lots of young people, young professionals, oh, I want to go and discover wine in real time. Like, I've been doing a lot of drinking and learning under lockdown. Where do I go? But I said, fuck, maybe I should start this wine club that everyone's looking for. So I started something called Dalston Wine Club, which is on a bit of a hiatus at the moment as I've kind of been finishing the book and, you know, evaluating what direction my career is going to go in the next few years or so. But it was through Dalston Wine Club that I then started garnering, you know, real interest from not just young people, but young professionals and the industry itself. So that's kind of not so much. It's a big nutshell, but that's sort of how I've gotten to where I am today in a largish nutshell.
Yeah, coconut shell or something like
that. Coconut, yes, let's call it a coconut shell.
Yeah. You mentioned preloading. You called it pre-drinks. Slightly different thing, I suppose. But there's a chapter dedicated to pre-drinks, not preloading, mm-hmm. I should say, in the book. And you, I'm assuming, if you were bringing nice stuff to university, college, pre-drinks, you were probably in a minority, weren't you?
Yes, 100%. Although I don't know if I would say nice. I was the only person there with a full bottle of Prosecco. I don't know who I thought I was. I was just kind of bringing a full bottle of Prosecco to pre-drinks when everyone else, yeah, you're right, it was generally beers. Or I remember at the college bar, there was one kind of wine that you could get called Straw Hat. I don't know if you're familiar with Straw Hat.
No, I'm not sure I want to be.
Well, there was a red, white and a rosé Straw Hat. I think it was because it was like a part subsidized college bar. It was quite cheap. So I think these bottles of wine were £4. So if anyone was bringing a bottle of wine to pre-drinks or pre-gaming, whatever you want to call it, it was Straw Hat. And if that was people's first interaction with wine, then I'm not surprised people never drunk wine again. Sorry if anyone from Straw Hat is listening, but the stuff was undrinkable. There was also something called the Rainbow Mile that was kind of like a society thing where you would drink a bottle of, or what was it, a pint? Yes, you would drink a pint of white wine, do 800 meters, do a pint of rosé, then a pint of red, and repeat the horrible process until, I don't know, you passed out, I guess. But yeah, university drinking culture, I'm very glad to have it behind me.
I was going to say, the book is definitely not about binge drinking, is it?
No, not at all.
No. You do say it's a deeply unserious wine book. I mean, you don't just say that. It's written as a description in big letters at the front. Why were you so keen for it to be deeply unserious?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. I think that it kind of lies at the core of everything I do. So the reason I wanted the fact that it was a deeply unserious wine book at the core of the book itself is because I don't take many things extremely seriously. I mean, I absolutely adore the world of wine, through which I've had incredible experiences, met some of my favorite people and tasted countless amazing wines. And as a bit of like a history and anthropology buff, it's incredibly gratifying. But would I don't know, sacrifice my firstborn child for it? Definitely not. I think that a lot of people kind of approach wine with a real seriousness, which is great. I do take a lot of wine like very seriously. I take my pleasure and my enjoyment of it very seriously. But I think it's the seriousness that puts people off getting into it in the first place. I think that, you know, as with getting into anything or trying something new or trying a new hobby, you're just anxious about the mistakes you make. And, you know, I think in wine more so than perhaps many other areas of interest, people are a little bit less forgiving because quite a high level of knowledge, I feel like, is required for people to feel confident about talking about it in the first place. So I think that through, as a wine professional, being like, guys, I don't take myself too seriously, so why should you be afraid to make mistakes? Everyone makes mistakes when they're learning about something as deeply complex as wine. Putting kind of the word unserious on the front cover is just sort of a representation of that, really. I don't take myself too seriously, so neither should you.
Yes, and the wine world doesn't always help itself. There's the, you know, old cliche of someone saying that they don't like Chardonnay, but it turns out they do like Chablis. And then everyone has a good laugh about the fact that Chablis is, of course, Chardonnay. But actually, I always cringe because, in a sense, you shouldn't have to know which grape goes in which wine. If you like Chablis, just knowing you like Chablis is enough, isn't it?
100%. And I think I talk about in the book, you know, I also talk about in my wine club, so long as you're armed with the kind of wine that you like, unless you're looking to go into a career in wine, but most people who come to my wine clubs aren't. They're just looking for the vocabulary and they're looking for the information. I say, if you go into a wine shop or a restaurant armed with the knowledge of the wine that you yourself like, then you're completely unstoppable. And really, it's great to explore and discover, but do you really need to know anything else? I think it's crazy that such a high level of knowledge is needed or required for you to be taken seriously as, you know, like a wine buff or someone with an interest in wine, when, yeah, you're right, that's all you really need to know.
Yeah, and actually, Chablis, that's quite a good observation on their part, because it is a bit different to what you'd get in the Côte d'Or or whatever. So it's even a really good observation. It's just that people react to it in a certain way. And that brings us neatly to the glossary. I wouldn't normally kind of dwell on a glossary in talking to someone about their book, but I think it's really relevant here to what you just said. And you've got a really neat way of explaining some quite complex things in the glossary. I was particularly struck by carbonic maceration, because I spent anxious weeks or even months trying to understand, while I was doing my diploma, the complex process of intracellular fermentation. And actually, you've managed to boil down carbonic maceration to about 25 words.
Ah, yes. Well, I mean, I think I say in the book, like, who's got time to be reading a glossary? And if you want it to be, you know, I don't think that it's a book that you read cover to cover. I want it to be a book that you kind of dip in and out as and when you need it. And if you do see a word that you don't necessarily understand, then you don't necessarily want to be spending. I mean, I, for one, you know, love taking the time to read longer pieces of text on, yeah, exactly the kinds of processes you're talking about. But the average person, do they? I mean, there's also, like, as you say, like, a wealth of knowledge and information out there if you want to get really nerdy with it. But if you're dipping in and out of a book to, you know, get the information you need and maybe have a laugh, then yeah, I think it's important to kind of maybe not dwell too long and really only kind of give you the key need to knows, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to give the wrong impression of the book here, because I'm going to talk about malolactic fermentation now. This is not what the book is about. This is the glossary and that's it. But I'm just curious as to where you honed your skills in translating complex things into very, very simple, relatable language, because you're very good at it.
Oh, that's very kind of you. I think that most definitely comes from my work as a copywriter. So I've always been a copywriter, and a lot of that is, yeah, as you say, honing things down and making, like, selling things in, I don't know, yeah, 25 words or less. And I think also what I've learned as a copywriter, and one of the most important skills that I've learned as a copywriter going into this and becoming an author, is really refining your audience and what they need to know and what they want to get out of. I think that with wine writing, it can go one of two ways, right? You're either there, like, solely to serve and inform, or you're there to be like, oh, look what a great writer I am. And I think I'm kind of like somewhere in the middle. Obviously, I want everyone to have a laugh and not take things too seriously when they're reading the book. But at the same time, we are ultimately there to serve and relay information and kind of draw people in and welcome them into the world of wine in that way. So yes, I would say my background in copywriting for sure is what's really, really helped me refine some of these concepts and make them a little bit digestible for the reader.
We've established it's a great glossary. Let's get on to the book itself, because it's not an encyclopedia at all. It is broadly about pairing wines with situations. How did that idea come about?
So I get a lot of DMs, direct messages on social media and emails, to be fair, from people asking me for their wine recommendations. Generally speaking, it's kind of like this new generation of wine drinkers. So, you know, early 20s to late 30s, early 40s. And I've kind of noticed a pattern that's popped up over the past, you know, 5 years four years post lockdown, when a lot more people in that age bracket got into wine. I've found that when they get in touch, they don't say, oh, I'm having a fillet of salmon tonight, what should I have? I found that when this generation wants something that's perfectly matched, to the food they're eating. They're very happy to go out and pay for like a very qualified professional to do that for them. At home, however, it tends to be, so yeah, it's not, I'm having a fillet of salmon, what should I have? It's, I'm going to a barbecue and I don't know anyone. Like, what wine do I bring to, you know, make some new friends? Or I'm meeting my girlfriend's parents for the first time. What wine do I bring to like really impress them? So I find that people are drinking more situationally, and they care more about things like, you know, who they're drinking the wine with and how much they should be spending. And the idea that when you bring a bottle of wine to a function, it ultimately does say something about you. So yeah, it's kind of rooted in practicality, but also the book is quite whimsical. I do say in the intro, like, by no means am I saying that you should only bring a vino verde to pre-drinks, that there are a wealth of options. But, you know, these situational wine pairings are just a way to kind of get people to think about why they drink the wine they drink and why they do it in those situations and what it is about those wines that, you know, endears them to a particular situation. So that's how the book came about, and hopefully it helps with that.
Yeah, it's very personal, the book as well, isn't it? Because you're dealing with your own experiences. I mean, there's a pairing for what to enjoy when you've just had sex, for example, and I've never seen that ever in a wine book.
Thankfully, I don't go too personally into that one. I think that no one wants to read about that. But I think that when people drink wine, when normal people drink wine the day to day, they're not drinking it in a tasting room. They're not drinking it in, you know, a wine cellar around lots of people that, you know about wine. They enjoy wine domestically. So yeah, whether it's, you know, like you say, having sex, or whether they're on like a good date or a bad date, or they're enjoying a massive fuck off takeaway on a sofa with their partner, these are the situations when people are drinking wine. And I think that because these drinking experiences are domestic and they're not happening in a tasting room, I think people don't take them as seriously as they should. They're like, oh, I'm only drinking wine at home, or I'm only drinking it with my partner. It's like, well, those drinking experiences are just as valid, and they're just as much an opportunity to learn as, you know, spending £120 in a tasting, which is an amazing, you know, once in a while treat. But not everyone can afford those experiences, and it's the discovery of wine at home that I think I really wanted to hone in on. And yeah, doing that through like my own personal experiences, I think, is a good way to do that, because hopefully people find it relatable and they kind of see me in their own drinking experiences as well.
And certain wines, their distinctive aromas, that particular taste can be really obviously memorable, but also they can be synonymous with a particular situation, a particular moment in your life, can't they?
Yes, 100%. And that's actually not something that I've thought about too much, but now that you bring it up, yeah, I mean, wine is so intrinsically linked to memory. Yeah, like you say, you can have a taste of a wine and just be immediately brought back. Or even when you're tasting wine and thinking of notes, you might taste something and be like, oh my gosh, it tastes of like my grandmother's blackberry jam or something like that. So yeah, you're right. As much as it is, you know, linked to personal experiences, it also is ultimately linked to memory. And I think that's probably why I've drawn up on my own personal experiences in this book.
Yeah. And there's, you know, a rollicking good read of personal experiences in there that, you know, made me laugh out loud quite a bit, and actually that was in itself was quite embarrassing, because some of this was on a British Airways plane from Barcelona to London. So if you were on that plane and there was a mad person looking at his phone and occasionally laughing out loud, then that was me reading your proof. So I don't want to spoil the stories by revealing too many of them, because people need to get the book. It's whimsical, as you say, so it's not you're not a doctor, it's not a prescription. But there are, you give advice on wines for certain situations. Let's just take a few examples. You mentioned a first date that's going well, or a date that's not going well. It's Prosecco for the latter, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, the date that's not going well. That's correct.
That's right. Just explain your rationale there.
So this is one that was rooted, as I say, in faultless logic. So I kind of, again, draw on my own personal experiences of, I think that a lot of Prosecco gets a bad rap, which is fair because a lot of it is not very well made, but it is widely available by the glass. A lot of this book was also kind of born of the idea that you wouldn't order the same thing on a date that's going well as opposed to a date that's not going well. So I had, well, you're obviously not going to order a bottle if you've already made a decision like, oh, fuck, I never want to see this person again. This man is completely insufferable. So I suggested Prosecco because it's on by the glass in most restaurants. You are definitely not buying a bottle. There's no sexual chemistry. He's really annoying you. You've already texted your friend asking them to fake the death of their cat. And you kind of want to make a quick exit. And I do quite like the idea of an ironic glass of bubbles to toast a really bad date. And also, you know, it tends to be a smaller pour, so you can make a swift exit even swifter.
Particularly useful for one of those dates where the person is not as advertised, i.e. they don't look like their picture.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
I've had friends who've had to try and escape such situations. That's never happened to me, but I have had, I did a laugh at the dating stuff because one of my first dates when I was in my early 20s, I thought it was a good idea to meet a guy at a model village.
Oh, wow. Which model village was it?
Beaconsfield in Buckinghamshire. It's a nice model village, just not necessarily the place that you'd meet another 20-year-old gay man, really, to
that's
be honest.
So,
yeah, but also I noticed that you said that inviting someone round for dinner, where you'd obviously potentially enjoy a really good bottle of wine, that's a bit of a no-no as well.
Well, yeah, taking someone out for dinner, I think I meant, so booking a reservation. That's quite a big commitment for someone that you don't potentially know too well just yet. I certainly wouldn't invite anyone that I'd met for the first time back for dinner. That would be insane or adventurous. I don't know. But I really like the idea of a model village. Maybe I should try that.
It didn't work very well. I have to warn you.
It was quite a short date. Yeah, it wasn't a walking date.
Yeah, it made us feel, you know, big and tall, I suppose. But that was about it. And then you've got meeting the parents for the first time, i.e. meeting somebody else's parents. And Cabernet is king here. Why?
So I think when we're going with parents, we're going for familiarity. I mean, I've done copywriting for a fair few, you know, wine retailers, merchants, and Cabernet is still king among the, you know, older generation of drinkers. You know, it's familiar. It creates wines of like body and power, which is still something that's very appealing. It's food friendly because we assume that you might be enjoying a meal with the parents. Well, I hope so. Yeah, that's the reason I went for it. I think that, you know, Cabernet is one of those really familiar grapes to the older generations. It tends to seem a bit more luxurious. So, you know, maybe they will assume that you own a bed frame or you have all your own teeth. So that's always a good bet when you're trying to endear yourself to someone. And also a constituent in many Bordeaux blends, which, you know, again, gives like this image of, yeah, I know what I'm talking about. I pay my taxes on time and I am I'm good news.
Yeah. And then you, assuming things don't go so well with the parents, you've also got a wine for being dumped.
Yeah.
And that probably, or at least it should have happened to all of us, I think. It's an experience we all need to go through. Versus doing the dumping, which is obviously painful too. And I think the former, being dumped, that's a Barbaresco. Just go through the logic there.
Yeah, so Barbaresco, I mean, one of my favourite wines. And I think that, you know, with something, I mean, I've just gone through a breakup myself. And I actually did indulge in some Northern Italian red. So I'm nothing if not true to my word. I think that, you know, what you want from a wine like this is it needs to be grounding. So you've kind of got like that earthiness of the Barbaresco, but also kind of still like a great acidity to kind of, you know, keep you awake when you're lamenting your woes and have all your friends around smoking heavily on your sofa. I also find it quite, you know, while it's quite a grounding wine, it's quite a sensual wine as well. And, you know, I think that it's something that helps. I always kind of talk about like brain spring cleaning or like emotional spring cleaning. And I think that, you know, quite a lot of crying and lamenting and, you know, going around in circles is need for that. And I think that, yeah, you need something earthy, grounding, but with a fabulous, you know, bright-eyed acidity to sort of keep you in check, keep you awake, and maybe not get you as drunk as you perhaps intend to.
Yeah, and as you say, it's very good for those sofa friends who come round to comfort you as well, isn't it? They'll enjoy it too.
For sure.
You are at the time of your life where suddenly everyone is getting married. You describe it as an inescapable tidal wave of other people's happiness, which made me smile. Now, anyone who works in the world of wine cannot escape being asked for wedding wine recommendations. Quite often it's by someone, I think, genuinely believing it might be the first time that question has been asked. And it can be a lot of work, actually, but of course, it's a lovely thing to do as well. I'm guessing you get asked for wedding wine recommendations quite a bit at the moment.
It genuinely does seem to be at that time where it feels like everyone is getting engaged. It's become quite cool to get married young again, which is really nice. I have a lot of friends and, you know, their late 20s getting engaged, and it's always really lovely. But yeah, some of them work in wine, some of them don't. And, you know, and in the midst of a cost of living crisis, well, now a recession, obviously value for money is absolutely key. So I do make my suggestions in the book with that in mind. So, for example, I do believe that with the I can't remember which one I suggest Allegotto for, but I think that Allegotto is just such a fabulous way.
That's the party wine. That's the open bar wine, I think.
Ah, perfect. Oh, yeah, ideal. So, yeah, I think I say in the book, you know, when you're looking for an open bar wine, or you're at least looking to buy some wine in advance to, you know, serve to your guests, you know, quantity is definitely key. The number one thing that I hear people complain about is if there's any money behind the bar, or what kind of quality the wine was. Or actually, you know what? It wasn't even quality. It's just how much of it there is. So bulk is definitely the key here. And I think Allegotto is such a fabulous grape, fabulous wine to really find value, especially for people that, you know, are being priced out of Burgundy or the more expensive French regions. I think that, you know, I've had some amazing Allegotto over the last year or so. It's kind of creeping its way into the wine lists of London, and it's always a pleasure to, you know, have something that is handled with the same care, grace, and attention as like a Burgundian winemaker would usually just bestow on their Chardonnay. But yeah, I think it's a fabulous place to find value, and you can find it on the cheap, and it tastes really, really fucking good. So, yeah.
So, yeah, Allegotto, really interesting example. The quality is streets ahead of what it was even perhaps a decade ago.
Yeah, it's becoming incredibly reliable, and I think it's, you know, it's testament to the fact that there is no such thing as a bad grape, just an unimaginative winemaker. And I think that the fact that, you know, as you say, quality is becoming ever more consistent, it's proof that, you know, you just need to bestow the same love and care as you would with your Chardonnay or your Pinot Noir, and amazing, lovely things can happen for a fraction of the price.
I was interested in the choice of grapes that you recommend, because you have some classics there. You're talking about Nebbiolo and some of the great Burgundy Chardonnay, but also you have some Outre grapes. We've mentioned Allegotto already, which is relatively niche. And then you're a big fan of Zweigelt from Austria.
Yes, that is probably because I'm friends with Freddy Bulmer, who is the Austrian buyer at the Wine Society, who's really opened my eyes to the quality of it. But kind of going back to what we were talking about before, about the evolving tastes of, you know, this new generation of wine drinkers, I mean, more so than ever, they're willing to experiment, try something new. And frequently I'm seeing, you know, really fabulously made Zweigelt on wine lists. I'm seeing people are kind of, you know, turning to it for an alternative for when they want, you know, a nice light red that they can chill, because chilled reds are still a thing. They're not going away anytime soon. And yeah, I think it's, I think that my inclusion of that grape is more of a symptom of that, really.
And it's really important to shine a light on some of those grapes, because there's some horrible statistic about, you know, I think something like 80% of the world's wine consumption involves about four grapes or something, doesn't it?
Yeah, if that is a terrifying statistic. But yeah, I hope hopefully that will change. I really hope that will change. And, you know, what I'm seeing in my wine clubs and the kind of wines that people are excited to try is anything to go by, then hopefully that will change.
You also include a chapter on how to hack a pub wine list. And pub wine lists are variable, it's fair to say. A lot of them are amazing and some are really, you know, rudimentary. What's your advice on how to enjoy wine in a great British boozer?
Yeah, so well, yeah, I think it's important to clarify that when I'm talking about, you know, your pub wines, I mean, I'm not talking about the fabulous places in London or any of the big cities where, as you say, people put a great deal of effort into their wine lists. I'm talking about, you know, when I'm talking about the kind of place where I grew up, like in the Midlands, where I don't know if you've seen Hot Fuzz, that fabulous film, but it goes in and says, I'll have a glass of wine. He says, what's your selection? He goes, we've got red or white. And that's generally speaking it. There's like the selection is few and far between. My advice for hacking a pub wine list is, you know, a lot of wines tend to be varietally labeled, so your Pinot Grigio, your Sauvignon Blanc. But the way to hack, as you put it, kind of like a pub's wine list, is go for the wines that, you know, have a DOC. So, for example, I think I make the suggestion of a white Rioja. So a white Rioja.
You do, yes. Good choice.
Jump through several hoops to be able to put the words white Rioja on the bottle pertaining to, you know, oak aging, bottle aging. So, you know, it has to be of a certain standard in order to have those words on the bottle. So that is my main piece of advice. But generally speaking, when I have had a white Rioja in a pub, it's been really nice.
Yeah, and I would say the same, actually. I'm always quite surprised to find it. And then when I have it, I really enjoy it. So the kind of pub you're talking about there, it's the kind of place that I've blundered into and said, could I have a look at the menu? And they've said, yeah, we've got ready salted cheese and onion and salt and vinegar. That's the sort of extent of it. Nothing wrong with that if that's where you like to hang out, I should add. Wine in a can is something that has come a long way in a short space of time, and that gets a positive mention from you.
Yes, for sure. I think that, you know, it's one of those classic things. I think I resisted wine in a can for a long time, and then I actually tried it. I was like, okay, fine, yeah, this is actually quite good. I think we associate wine in a can with something that you hastily grab when you're at Waterloo and you're going on a train to go and see a friend. But, you know, we've come so, and yeah, it tends to be for things like, you know, a Provence Rosé, a Sauvignon Blanc. But I think that, you know, we've come, like you say, a really long way with the quality of wine that we have in cans. I mean, just talking about, I've seen Zweigel in cans, I've seen orange wine in cans. But then there is the thing of to get the full experience of a wine, you know, so much of it is the sense of smell. And, you know, when it's trapped inside a can and all you're getting is taste, it can feel a little bit limiting. So ironically, to enjoy a canned wine, I like to put it in a glass, which kind of defeats the whole point. But, you know, places are even putting canned wine on their wine lists. So confidence in it is growing. And, you know, I'm seeing more different kinds of wine in cans than ever before. So hopefully that's going to be a very exciting growing sector.
Yeah, I'm with you, by the way. I think it's a fantastic format for freshness, especially those kind of wines that you want to be steely and crisp. But I'm afraid if I possibly can, I will pour it into a glass. Yeah. I don't like drinking it from the can. I'm perfectly happy to have a Coke Zero from a can, but I'd like my wine to be served from a vessel of some kind. But it's a great format, and I think it's great that it gets the positive mention that it does, and the quality is reflecting that. I loved your description of Provence Rosé, of which I am an enormous fan, as proper party fuel, because it can be a serious wine, but actually it is the ultimate slips down far too easily wine, isn't it?
Yes, I agree.
Tell us why Provence Rosé works so well in that context.
It's just something about, not just specifically Provence Rosé, but rosés in general. I think it's the fact that it's pink. It just gets you in the mood. It's, yeah, as you say, it slips down all too easily. But I talk about thinking wines as opposed to drinking wines. So thinking wines, you know, you ruminate, there's something quite complex and interesting going on. And drinking wine's the kind that you can, you know, knock back and enjoy with friends. I kind of think that Provence Rosé is somewhere in the middle, because like you say, it's got some of the best examples have something really fascinatingly interesting going on. But at the core of it, you have like this gorgeous, you know, center of red, beautiful, crunchy fruit, which I just think makes the perfect party drinking. And I'm also a big advocate for enjoying rosé all year round. I don't think we should limit ourselves to, you know, just when it's sunny outside. I mean, if we did that in the UK, then we'd only drink rosé 2 days a year. But I think that, yeah, rosé all year round. I think Provence rosé is a great option for celebration.
It so is. I'm like a broken record on that subject. It's definitely a winter wine, not least for the escapism that it can give you in winter. You can at least get those aromatics, look at that colour, and you can start thinking about summer and sunny days and those 2 days a year that you mentioned that we can enjoy being outside with that wine. Which sort of brings us neatly into something that you don't do in the book, unless I've missed it, which is choose an absolute favourite wine. But we tend to sort of round off our interviews here with a desert island wine, a wine that, you know, if you were stuck, it might be simpler to say it was a death row wine, but that's kind of not a very nice thought, really. So we tend to say desert island, but if you were stuck, you could only have one wine ever again. What would it be?
Oh, interesting question. I think that I would go for a white Burgundy. Yeah, I think white Burgundy gives me everything that I want from a wine. I mean, like the examples I'm drinking a lot at the moment. So when I kind of go to buy white Burgundy, I'm kind of going for Saint-Aubin. I just need something that, you know, has that ripe roundness, kind of like that lick of Cornish butter, that core of like lovely, generous, you know, orchard fruit. But I also just love that the best examples have just such a, like a brilliant, like piercing acidity. And that's something that I really look for when I'm going with my wines. I also find that, you know, Weitberg tends to be something that compare with most anything. Love it with, I mean, I'm also not a big red meat eater, but I love it kind of with, you know, something like lightly, like a light gingery beef sort of situation with rice. I think it's a really versatile wine. So it suits the food that I want to eat. And yeah, I just can't get enough of it, really.
Yeah, this is assuming there's food available.
Yeah, but then it also becomes a death row meal because I will definitely die if I only have white Burgundy to drink.
Yeah, true. That's a great choice. And it's a classic. And as I say, what's lovely about the book is that you don't try to make it kind of too cool for school. It's not just about natural wines and alternative grape varieties, for want of a better word. You really reference the classics quite a lot. You clearly have a kind of broad spectrum of wine love in the book, which makes it you know, hugely diverse and very, very enjoyable. So it's out now and it's called Corker. And it's a corker. So Hannah, congratulations, and it's great to chat to you. Thanks for coming on The Drinking Hour.
Thank you so much. So nice to finally meet you.
Likewise.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Well, let's round off as ever with a selection of medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame, and I try to keep it topical, as regular listeners will know. So here's my best stab at some topical suggestions for Hannah. She suggests Brunello di Montalcino is your best bet if someone else is paying. So here's a gold medal winner to have on your wish list. La Torgata Seconda Stella Adestra 2018. Brunello di Montalcino won 95 points, gold medal. The judging overseen by Master of Wine Alistair Cooper, an Italian expert, of course. And here's our tasting note. This masterpiece is heady and intense. Blackberries and raspberries are first to entice, swiftly followed by leather, smoked meat and wet slate. Layers upon layers. The palate manages to be fresh and umami with a finish you wish would never end. And For good measure, here's another Brunello that scored a very high silver with 93 points, Belpoggio 2018. The judging panel described it as super refined, plum, citrus peel and tobacco leaf with some graphite sprinkled into the mix, incredibly fine tannins and a lavender-like finish. Great, said the judges. As a wine to take round to your partner's parents, future in-laws perhaps, Hannah suggests a Cabernet Sauvignon. So here's inspiration from Chile with a gold medal winner, Mongras Intriga Maxima Cabernet Sauvignon 2020 from Maipo, the judging again overseen by Ali Cooper, MW. And here's the winning tasting note. Exotic, ripe, black fruits leap from the glass and follow to the palate where they blend seamlessly with toasty oak and silky tannins. Perfumed, savoury notes add to the complexity of the long, layered finish. And here's another gold medal winning cab. Robert Oatley Finisterre Cabernet Sauvignon 2018. One of a host of gold medals from the in-situ judging in Margaret River that we were talking about a few weeks back. It was awarded 95 points, so a gold medal. The panel said delicately elegant nose of blueberries and perfumed lavender with a serious palate of graphite and primary black fruits, creamy, sophisticated tannins and a fresh salinity giving texture with a long, rich and deliciously long length. And Hannah talks about White Rioja being a favourite, her go-to pub wine. It's a great choice. Here's a silver medal winner to look out for. Rioja Vega Colección Tempranillo Blanco 2022. The judging here, overseen by Dercy Uviana Jr., MW., and the panel said this, initially oaky on the nose, then tropical fruits develop. The palate is enjoyably waxy, ripe and broad, with complexity and layers of flavour, creating depth and interest. Very well-made wine. Enjoyable, they said. And talking of enjoyable, my thanks to Hannah for a thoroughly enjoyable chat. Corker is out now. And it comes highly recommended. Really enjoyed reading the excerpts of that for my preparation. We're back next week with the highlights of this series. But until then, thanks for joining us and goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.